Moncrief on News Talk.
Yes, it's time for Moncrief's Murder Club, where Cassie Delaney guides us through some strange and unexplained cases. Today we're talking about cases where things escalated in some rather unexpected ways. Cassie, good afternoon.
How are you? I like that little caveat in the jingle now. That's lovely.
Yeah, well, we're covering our ass just
yeah,
in case,
it does.
You know.
We can't do this without doing a lot of cons, and there's just so many to cover, and I love a con.
Yeah.
We've got a few of those today.
Yeah, and the first one involves knitting. Who knew?
So this is the thing, right? There are online communities of people, and you think they're just hobbyists, but these are the most passionate people you will ever find. Remind me to tell you about the clam chowder murder someday.
Okay.
It is a story of a murder that happened over a dispute in a clam chowder recipe in a Facebook group. Any Facebook groups are just an absolute, just
that's an episode of The Simpsons as well. Somebody was murdered at chowder.
Art imitates life, or vice versa. They're just a place where things often get chaotic. And this is what happened in this story. So this is the story of Danielle Glunt. Now, I'm going to be very careful about how I pronounce her name on the radio. I'll call her Danielle from here on out. So she was part of a knitting community. There's actually a separate site called Ravelry, and it is basically a Facebook but dedicated to crafters and knitters, anyone involved in any sort of hobby around yarn. And this story kicks off around 2006. So this is like the golden age of internet crafting. Everyone's popping off these little forums on Ravelry. They're sharing their patterns, they're sharing their yarns, they're sharing their things. It's just doty, cutie patootie kind of stuff. Etsy was new and exciting at the time, so you see a lot of crafters rising up there. And Danielle was a hand dyer of yarn operating out of New Mexico under her business name, Mystical Creations Yarn. People called it MCY for short. Now, her yarns were beautiful, hand dyed with kind of natural materials, really deep saturated colours. She had unusual combinations, and it was the kind of thing, like the kind of yarn that knitters would really seek, you know, just beautiful, really interesting, could make lovely jumpers or blankets or whatever out of it. And when Danielle's shop was picked up by a crafting podcast, she just went through the roof, just absolutely skyrocketed to fame in a very niche circle. All right. But like, she was really, really well known. And this meant that loads of orders kept coming in through the shop, more than she could handle. It was around $20 for a skein of wool as well. So like, she was getting kind of raking them in, but couldn't dye them and ship them out fast enough.
Mm.
So instead of, she kind of fell behind in the orders, and instead of putting maybe a freeze on the shop or going out with a notice, she just kept taking the orders and became more and more overwhelmed. And then things started to take a turn for the worse, because yarn colours were arriving in the wrong colours, or they didn't arrive at all. And when people were leaving feedback on the shop, they were getting reported. And this was affecting their, you know, their social scores on Ravelry and impacting how they were able to engage with the community. So it was, even a report came in that some of the yarn was, the dye was bleeding off and impacting the other yarns. So it was real uproar now in the community over this. And so the forums began to fill up talking about her. There was, you know, this kind of little chat group sort of element to Ravelry, and people were complaining about MCY. So an email then went out to all her customers explaining that Danielle had been hospitalized with an illness, and to please be patient and kind, and that her sister, Margaret, was trying to fulfill the order. So naturally people were like, oh, poor Danielle, of course we don't mind being patient. Very generous community at the core, and they were really, really patient with her and really sending best wishes, and the kind of the giving out stopped and things seemed to calm down a little bit. But then another email came in to customers, and these are people who may be waiting on shipments, saying that Danielle had been diagnosed with leukemia and that she was actually dying. And then on the 8th of March 2008, a note went up on Ravelry saying that Danielle had died. No refunds, no anything was going to happen. A family member just thanked customers for their loyalty to her store.
Okay, tragic.
Very, very tragic. And it should end there. But the knitting community felt there was the thread that needed to be pulled. Pardon the pun. Could not. A former associate of Danielle's came forward and stated that Danielle was not ill, and the siblings described in the family emails did not exist at all. None of them. So Margaret didn't exist. Her another sister she'd made up called Jean didn't exist. It was all just Danielle writing her own fictional grieving posts and faking her own death to get out of posting out this hand-dyed yarn. So within days of the death announcement, a new website had popped up called Visionary Yarns, selling the same yarn and had the same phone number and the same PO box as Mystical Creation Yarns. So someone called the number, Danielle answered the phone, but then denied that it was her. Then came the obituary, and someone posted what appeared to be an obituary for Danielle on Ravelry, and the community quickly realised it was a pay-to-print death notice from someone else entirely. And the IP address connected to the post traced back to the account linked to Mythical Creations. I mean, these people are going deep. They don't, yeah. They're not letting you away with anything. So someone then started posting on the forums about the mysterious Margaret sister, who of course didn't exist, and realised that Danielle's middle name was actually Margaret. So she wasn't even covering her tracks that well. So complaints had filed in. They actually opened up an FBI investigation with a special unit in the IC3 investigation unit, because it was the nature of it just being early in internet crime and fraud, and just, I guess, there's a bit of excitement across your desk. And then came a sighting of Danielle in real life. So a fellow resident of Edgewood posted in the forums saying that, "I thought the helper should know that a woman claiming to be Danielle, presenting Danielle's driver's license with an address and proof of ID, was seen and overheard today depositing checks at a neighbourhood branch. She was driving a brand new car with dealer stickers and tags still on it." So she'd taken everyone's money, bought the car, still dyeing yarn and still walking around in the same town without a care in the world.
Yeah, and the new business that she'd set up.
Exact same.
But did that continue to sell yarn to people?
It continued for a while, but when I think it all things escalated off, she quietly disappeared. She was never charged with anything criminally, even though she had essentially, I think, what's the charge? It's like theft by default or theft by deception. She had frauded them out of their money.
Yeah.
Got away with it scot-free.
And was never heard of again.
No doubt living in a lovely little manor with loads of knitted goods and crocheted coasters and all the likes.
A little knitted house she made herself, that when it rains, the dye runs out of it. How strange.
Very, very strange.
Presumably Ravelry have put in kind of, you know, there's all sorts of safeguards now.
They do now. So they have, the yarn community have gotten tighter and they've put safeguards in place. So monitoring systems like that they put in place to keep track of anybody who might be up to the similar things. They're called the Ravelry Rubberneckers as well. And they just keep tracking of the drama so that nobody ever gets away with this ever again.
Right. OK, now the next case has items in common with the yarn case, though it's way more tragic than that anyway. So so tell us about Janelle Potter.
Yeah, so this one is another case where kind of, if you're on the internet, things escalate really, really quickly or can get out of hand madly quickly. So Janelle Potter was a 30-year-old woman living with her parents in Mountain City in East Tennessee. She had some health problems, including diabetes, so it meant that she spent a lot of time in her home, and she didn't have a job, didn't drive a car. So her parents kind of cared for her and she stayed in with them. So her primary connection to the outside world became the internet and majority Facebook, which can be a dangerous place. So she made a lot of friends on the internet. And one of these friends was actually a local woman called Tracy. And through Tracy, Janelle met Tracy's brother, Billy Payne, and developed quite a significant crush on Billy, almost to obsessive levels. So when Billy moved in with his girlfriend, also called Billie Jean.
Yes, okay.
Yeah, Janelle was devastated. They ended up having
Tennessee,
They had a baby together. So Janelle was kind of watching this and, you know, the green-eyed monster was coming out and she was fuming. So what followed then was a couple of Facebook feud posts, comments and like petty online back and forth. And eventually it led to Billie Jean and Tracy and unfriending Janelle. So that should, again, that's the point in the story where you think things should end and de-escalate. But Janelle just could not get over this. She just wasn't letting it lie. So she did the most extraordinary thing in that she created not just a fake profile, but an entirely fake person with a job, named him Chris, and Chris was a CIA agent. But Chris began contacting Janelle's parents and her boyfriend, Jamie Kurtz. So Janelle had a boyfriend this whole time.
Yeah, even though she was obsessing over this other guy.
And warning them. So she created this whole scenario in which she pretended to be the CIA agent who was getting in touch with Janelle's family to let them know that Janelle was in danger, being in the kind of peripherals of Billy and Billie Jean, that they were threatening her. And Janelle just let this escalate to this wild, wild kind of level where she'd created all these other fake people around it and fake profiles that were leaving her false abuse online. So her parents and her family became genuinely really worried about her because they believed they were talking to a CIA agent. Chris was contacting them separately in their own emails. So much so that Janelle's mother kind of built this relationship with Chris and was referring to him as a son. Like, he was that embedded into their family and their home life. And because Janelle kept reinforcing this story with these fake Facebook posts of abuse she was getting, the whole thing seemed very believable. Because to step back and say, well, that doesn't seem real, would be, you know, who would create a world so bizarre and so, you know, expansive just to abuse oneself, you know, especially over such a small minor inconvenience of them being unfriended. So Janelle's parents became more increasingly stressed and worried for her. Janelle's father, Marvin Potter, was a former Vietnam Marine. So he kind of had, you know, his training. Everybody called him Buddy, a very nice, respected man. And his whole mission in life was to protect his family. So he became more and more protective of Janelle as the CIA agents, Chris's warnings proliferated and he was getting more and more in. So Janelle got to the point where she was so stressed with this that her father and her boyfriend, Jamie, became so concerned that on the 13th of January 2012, they went to Billy and Billy's home, Billy Squared, and shot them both dead, believing that they were an active and real threat to Janelle. And it was only when police interviewed Jamie that he eventually broke. And before he kind of said anything, he asked in the interview, is Chris the CIA agent here? And obviously investigators were really confused, didn't know what he was talking about. Why would this be a CIA matter? And then the investigators found all the emails. And there was hundreds of emails from Chris. There was hundreds of fake profiles. This whole expansive world that Janelle had constructed over the course of years. Like, this has been going on for a really, really long time. The forensic linguistics were able to compare the writing style of Chris to Janelle's and found patterns identical enough to establish that she was the author of these emails. And every post, every email was tracked back to the IP address of Janelle and her parents' home. So she had kind of created this situation where she coerced those around her into committing this, you know, incredibly egregious act. The whole family naturally was convicted. So Marvin Potter, the father, he received two consecutive life sentences. Barbara, the mother, received 25 years. Janelle received two life sentences herself. Jamie Courage, who cooperated with the prosecutors, received 25 years, even though he'd been one of the guys to pull the trigger.
Yeah.
It was an absolutely wild case.
Yeah. Why did the mother get a sentence?
I think because she had not questioned it, and maybe must have known that Buddy and Jamie were off to kill these two. I'd say it's something they discussed over the dinner table a couple of times.
Sandwiches for them.
Yeah.
And they went off.
Maybe she was driving the getaway car.
It's extraordinary that nobody thought the CIA. If it was FBI, it might be a bit more credible.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing, though, about kind of online cons and crimes. For a long time, I mean, this is 2012, so it's pretty recent. But for a long time, they sat in this grey area where they were, you know, there was a few regulations around it. It took a long time for the law to catch up. So people, I don't think, really understood. And going in, it's like the rise of AI now. Like, there's so many things that we're going to be caught out on because you go in with a certain level of trust. It doesn't occur to you that people are going to make these kind of things up and be fake. And everything seemed really convincing because it was. She had created actual profiles and was one of those kind of mad catfishers who was operating at all times.
And it sounds like Janelle had convinced herself.
I think I think she had certainly convinced herself that it was justified, that she had a right to do this, and she'd become, again, so embedded in it. And maybe it was one of those things that spiraled out of control. But the important thing to remember, she did absolutely nothing to stop it. Now, at prosecution, her defense attorney said that she functioned at the level of an 8 or 9 year old because she had received so little socialization in her life, because she'd spent so much time indoors, that she wasn't that developed. But she was developed enough to create this whole fictional world. So definitely seemed responsible.
That's extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You could see, because it was diabetes she had.
Yeah. I mean, she could have gotten out and about.
Yeah. You'd think so. And you'd wonder why the parents didn't let her out and about. Anyway, right. That brings us to our third story. Again, you can't get your head around it anyway. So this starts in Queens in New York. Yeah. Not that long ago.
So take yourself back to COVID times, if we're allowed to say that word. We're at a Tuesday evening in Queens, New York, November 2021. And there's a man called Glenn Hirsch. He's gone on his way home, stops in his local Chinese restaurant, The Great Wall. It's a place he's gone for years, likes to pick up the same kind of order. His food arrives and there in the order, there's not enough duck sauce. So he asks, they give it to him, little sachets of duck sauce, but he's still unhappy. He's just like, this has sparked some sort of level of upset in him. He demanded a refund, but the restaurant refused to give it back to him. And they explained that they couldn't accept food back because of COVID restrictions at the time. So they weren't going to take it back and give his money back. Now, again, a normal person would take the food here, take the extra duck sauce, go up home, eat your Chinese, and maybe assume that it would alleviate, that the crankiness would go. Maybe he was hangry at the time, but he didn't. This was a bee in his bonnet that just got worse and worse and worse over the next couple of months. So it became like an obsessive thought in his mind. It was a prolonged, escalating and baffling sort of story of what happened. Over the following months, he returned to the Great Wall again and again. He came back with a knife and told workers to be careful because this is the last time I'm going to tell you. He returned with a gun pointed at an employee and said, "I will kill your entire family." He slashed workers' tires. He made this takeaway restaurant like the focus of his obsession and like the entirety of his existence. He just became so unfaltering obsessed with it. The staff were genuinely terrified of him, didn't know when he'd be back or what he would do next. The workers said that he would constantly come in and threaten them and say things like he was going to kill their family. One of the workers was a 45-year-old delivery man called Jan, and he was a father of five who'd been at the restaurant for over a decade. And he expressed to colleagues multiple times how scared he was of Glenn Hirsch. So on the evening of April 30th, 2022, Hirsch drove to the Great Wall. He circled the block a couple of times in his car. And at around 9:30 that night, Jan left the restaurant on his scooter to go make a delivery. Hirsch followed him. He approached him on foot at an intersection, drew a gun and shot him once in the chest, killing him over duck sauce.
Yeah.
A father of five killed just while out doing his job because this man couldn't let his grievance with the order go. The investigation moved quickly. Surveillance cameras captured Hirsch circling the restaurant that night. Police had traced his movements back to his estranged wife's apartment, where they found eight guns, and he was arrested in June 2022. He was immediately dubbed the duck sauce killer.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
I mean, naturally. He was charged with murder, stalking and weapons possession. He pleaded not guilty. His brother posted his bail, and he was fitted with an ankle monitor and placed under home confinement. But then a couple of months later, when he failed to show up for court, officers went to search his apartment and found him dead with a self-inflicted gunshot wound. He left a note maintaining his innocence.
That's bizarre. That's the most bizarre aspect.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely indications that he was unwell and you know, maybe having some sort of maybe he believed the truth of it. But it certainly seemed to all kick off and start because of a lack of sachets of duck sauce in his order.
The strange thing about this is that he had turned up many times. He'd threatened people. He'd brought a knife. And presumably they would have reported this to the police.
Yeah. But I mean, imagine trying to explain to the officers why this started. You know? Like he couldn't, in no logical person's mind could you fathom that someone being upset at their order would lead to murder.
No, absolutely not. But even at that point, you know, if you had a brain, you'd go, there's something wrong with this guy and tell the cops about it. But maybe they didn't know his name or they...
They knew him because he'd been a regular at the restaurant for years.
Yeah, they'd probably even
deliver to
his house.
They knew him and he'd report him. But I think it's like, at what point does it become, you know, and him coming and threatening with the knife, yes, that should have been dealt with. He came at one point with the gun. But yeah, they should have had a 24-hour security officer outside the Great Wall.
Okay, anyone who's... works part-time delivering food now. Cold shivers going up their spine. Cassie, thanks a million as ever. Cassie Delaney there.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.